years old when his parents found him in the synagogues chatting with the old men, you know. And I think about that. I'm thinking, you know, some of these Rabbonim that were sitting there talking to him, they probably took it seriously. It probably really affected them. Mm-hmm. By the time Yeshua was teaching, they have 20 years of ministry under their belt, probably teaching some of the things he shared with them. They're hosed. They can't turn back now.
So his next objection is, the source of Jesus' wisdom is biblical and rabbinic parallels. And he points out, he gives us just a sampling of about 12 sayings of Yeshua that are either derived directly from the Tanakh or have a direct correlation, a direct echo in the Talmud or in Jewish literature. And so he says, you see, Jesus' teachings did not add anything original of moral or theological significance to Judaism. All right, so you can't fault him from deriving teaching and quoting from the Tanakh. That's what a rabbi does. All right, so that's a little bit ridiculous. But what about the charge that he's just parroting or, you know, repeating the teachings of the sages? In almost every instance, unless it's attributed to Hillel or someone earlier, but that rarely happens, in almost every instance where we see a direct correlation between a saying of the master and a saying of one of the sages, the sage that said it is a generation, two generations, three generations, four generations later than Yeshua. So it's a very clear, you know, it's not a question of, you know, what was he just ripping them off. It's which came first here. You know, which came first. Now the nice thing about the repetition of the master's teachings in Jewish context is that you get to see them in their, like, in their Jewish context. So even if it's a century or two centuries later, when you see it used within Judaism, it's like, oh, that's how it, yeah, that makes so much more sense. That's how that would work. Okay, so next point, the morally problematic statements. Starting in, we're just going to buzz through these, okay? Luke 19, verse 27. But these enemies of mine who did not want me to reign over them, bring them here and slay them in my presence. It's the end of a parable, right? Okay, why is this morally problematic? Well, you have some enemies, what do you do with them? You haul them in and you kill them. Is that really morally problematic from a Tanakh point of view, first of all? Would David have had a problem saying something like that? So no, that's not biblically morally problematic. And remember, Messiah is the son of David. He's called Son of David, Mashiach ben David. But nevertheless, this is from a parable as well. This is not a directive that he was giving anyone, right? John 15:6 is our next one. If anyone does not abide in me, he is thrown away as a branch and dries up, and they gather them and cast them into the fire, and they are burned. Is this morally problematic? Well, Asher Norman says that this verse, and this could be, I don't know, but he says that this verse is one that the church in the Middle Ages used to condone the Inquisition and the burning of Jews. So you can definitely see how that application of it is certainly morally problematic. But what is the verse really saying? It's not saying that you should take heretics and burn them. Instead, it says, if anyone does not abide in me, if anyone does not stay attached to the master, he is thrown away as a branch and dries up. This is something that happens spiritually. If you don't stay attached to your source of connection to God, to the way, the truth, and the life, you dry up. And then it says, and they gather them. Who's they? They is a circumlocution that's used all through the Gospels and rabbinic literature for God. Actually, for his angelic court. This is really common. You'll see this a lot if you just start paying attention to they. It's a circumlocution for God. So this is judgment at the hands of heaven, not on earth. So we're talking about what God does here. Not a problem. And then, I wish these would stay in the same book. Now we're back to Luke 22:36. And he said to them, "But now whoever has a money belt is to take it along, likewise also a bag, and whoever has no sword is to sell his coat and buy one." And then Matthew 10:34 is paired with that. "Do not think I come to bring peace. I come to bring a sword." So Asher Norman says, this statement was not allegorical. At Jesus' arrest, one of his disciples cut off the high priest's ear with a sword. So the implication then, by tying these two texts together and then citing the Peter incident in the garden, the implication is that our master was arming his disciples, telling them to arm themselves, and leading an insurrection, leading a political or military insurrection. Now, this is out of context, for sure. The "do not think I came to bring peace, I came to bring a sword" is meaning, don't think that the Messianic era is going to be all vines and fig trees. It starts with judgment. There's judgment, there's a purgation that we have to go through before we start the Messianic era. All right, and that can be supported from the prophets. This passage, "whoever has no sword, it should sell his coat and buy one," is in reference to his earlier instructions to the disciples that when he sent them out, they were not to bring a walking stick, they were not to bring a sword, they were not to bring them a money belt, right? So now he says, look, things are different. Things are going to be different now. This is going to be times of persecution, time of trouble is descending upon us. And so that's what he's indicating here. Peter takes him super literally and says, well, look, we have two swords right here. He says, it's enough of that. It's enough of that. And he warns Peter then, if you live by the sword, you'll die by the sword. So clearly, again, not an issue. Luke 14:26. You know that "don't think I came to bring peace, I came to bring a sword" is a really popular, that one is really popular. Not just in anti-missionary literature, but it's very popular in anti-missionary literature. Say, oh, Messiah brings peace, but look, this one brings a sword. Maimonides says that if the man does not come and fight the wars of God, he is not to be considered the Messiah. That's one of the criteria of Messiah, is that he must bring a sword to fight the wars of God. But even in Islam, that verse is cited all the time of like, oh, and the Christians, you know, the Christian, Christ cannot be the Messiah because he brings a sword. Okay, Luke 14:26. If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father, mother, wife, children, brothers, sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Well, that sounds morally problematic. It contradicts a couple things in Scripture, like honor your father and mother. So that does sound problematic. And you ever wonder about how the apostles then are always telling us, husbands, love your wives. Wives, honor your husbands. Love your children. All that these sorts of things. Have they never heard our master's teaching on what our family relationships should be like? That's right. People wonder why. Yeah, never mind. So what's the answer here? Yes. Yes, like how Jacob hated Leah, right? It says, when God saw that Leah was hated, Cain and Abel, yes. Jacob and Esau. So we have a Hebrew idiom that expresses an order of preference, it would seem.
They don't get this, it's right in the book.
Yeah, this one is a little irksome. But Matthew renders this very well. In Matthew 10, he renders it differently, translates it differently.
What was the original one? What was it?
The original was Luke 22. Wasn't it? No.
No.
Yeah, Luke 14. Luke 14, 26, yes. But Matthew gives it to us in Matthew 10, 37. And this is how he puts it. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And this makes good sense, because this is why I wanted Baba Metzia. This is in keeping with discipleship in the days of the Master. So here's a little bit about discipleship in the days of the Master, from Baba Metzia, picking up the Mishnah, Baba Metzia 33a. If one spotted, his lost object and his teacher's lost object, retrieving his own lost object takes precedence. I don't know why that is. If one spotted his father's lost object and his teacher's lost object, retrieving his teacher's lost object takes precedence. That's it. For his father is the one who brought him into this world, whereas his teacher, his rabbi, that taught him wisdom is the one who brings him into the world to come. It's his spiritual father. So the Torah says honor your father, but the sages say honor your teacher above your father. And that sounds problematic. It's like, oh, wait a second, honor your teacher above your father. That doesn't sound right. But that's exactly what the Master's saying. He's saying, you have to place me, your allegiance to me, above even your mother and your father, above even your family. If, however, his father was a scholar, then retrieving his father's object takes precedence. If one's father and his teacher are both carrying burdens and both of them need help putting them down, he should first put down his teacher's burden and only then should he put down his father's burden. If one's father and his teacher are both held captive, he should first ransom his teacher and only then should he ransom his father. And it goes on like this. So, I mean, that would, if we're just like reading that cold out of the Talmud, that would be a good example of, you know, why rabbinic literature is all jacked up. But we got the gospel to support it here. You know, so you realize, wait a second. That's exactly the context that our master was teaching out of. He was a sage. He was calling disciples. And he was telling his disciples, if you honor your father more than me, you're not worthy of me. And then there's an example of this. If you skip over to the right-hand column on your piece of paper, go halfway down to the really long reason. Jesus sinned by ordering his disciple to violate the commandments to, one, honor his father and mother, and two, promptly bury the dead. The story is like this. A man comes to the master, says, teacher, let me be your disciple. I want to be your disciple, but first, let me go bury my father. Yeshua says to him, let the dead bury the dead. As for you, follow me. Right? As for you, follow me. Okay, there's two problems here. One is, it seems that he's being told, don't honor your father. Well, we already answered that from the Talmud. Okay? The second, though, is there's a mitzvah to bury the dead. So, it sounds like he's saying, don't bury the dead. What we need to understand in this story, and there's a lot of explanations for this. It's a troubling passage. And so there's been a lot of explanations. Good explanations. I don't know which one's right. So I'll just tell you mine. This is how I understand it. I learned this from my brother. The man's not dead yet. Or, on the other hand, he's been dead for a couple months. Jewish burial happens on the same day. It's not as, let me bury my father and come, and then I'll come follow you. It's not like his father died, then he ran out to catch Jesus and said, hey, I want to be your disciple. I just got to go bury my dad, and I'll be right there. And Jesus is like, I don't have 10 minutes or whatever, you know. I mean, that's not the situation. So there's two possibilities. Either his father's not dead yet, and so he's saying, you know, my dad could die in a couple years. After that, I'll come. Then that's plausible. He's saying, no, you follow me now. You have to place the honor of your teacher above the honor of your father. Otherwise, you're not worthy of me. We already saw that in the Talmud. The other answer is that he's already dead and has been for some time. Because in first century Judaism, you practiced a secondary burial 12 months later. You buried in a tomb, let the body decompose, and then 12 months later you reopen the tomb, gather the bones, put them in an ossuary, and then the tomb's ready for reuse. And so my brother suggests that that's what had happened here. The man was saying, let me wait the 12 months while I say the Kaddish for my father, because that's where that the saying of the Kaddish originally comes from, waiting for the bones to be collected into the ossuary. It marks that period off. I'll say the Kaddish for my father, and then I'll collect the bones, put them in the ossuary, and then I'll come be your disciple. And the master says, no, let the dead bury the dead. Someone else can do that. Someone else can go in, collect the bones, put them in an ossuary. You have to prioritize your teacher if you're going to be a disciple, which we learn from the Talmud. So a very similar objection.
Who then are the dead?
Well, I think the dead are the people who aren't interested in the gospel. They're not interested in the message. They're not interested in Torah and devoting themselves to a life of Torah learning. They're just they're carrying on with their lives. They're at home. They have cable. They have... You know what I'm talking about. They're on Facebook every night. All right. John 9:39, Jesus said, for judgment I came into this world, so that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind. What's the point? Doesn't sound very nice. I don't have anything to say about that. John 3:36. Well, it doesn't sound very nice. But it's not, that doesn't make it morally problematic. You know, most of the things God says don't sound very nice. I mean, read the prophets. Jesus is a prophet. He's speaking as a prophet. And, you know, I mean, read Ezekiel. Read Isaiah. Read Jeremiah, for goodness sakes, you know?